Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 2 days ago, June 22nd, was the 80th anniversary of the most titanic clash of World War II when Nazi Germany invaded Soviet Communist Russia, each ruled by a murderous dictator. More than 20 million Russians were killed before the Nazis were defeated in 1945. Today's program, however, focuses on America's nearly forgotten war in Korea, which started when the politically divided peninsula was invaded in the south by its northern communist half on June 25, 1950, 71 years ago tomorrow, halfway through the halfway year of the 20th century. Korea was at once a civil war and a clash of surrogates in a nuclear Cold War between two world ideologies that had, 5 years earlier, won World War II against Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. Yet the Korean War is virtually forgotten in the immense shadow still cast by World War II, even though it killed almost 25,000 Americans, numerous allies, and hordes of Chinese and North Koreans, as well as more than a million Korean civilians on both sides of the 38th parallel. American veterans of Korea feel neglected, caught between memories and controversies of World War II and the Vietnam War of the 1960s and 70s. Yet the last very few remaining World War II veterans are virtually expired, which leaves Korean vets, whose numbers are rapidly diminishing, and Vietnam vets as the last participant survivors of America's 20th century wars. I start with Dr. Robert Brake, Ocean Park, Washington. War and Peace. These days, America goes to war, but few Americans do. Consider, compared to World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, how far removed we have become from any participation in the war effort. Less than 1% of our population now serves in the military, and only about 10% of them are on the front lines, risking life and limb. The rest of us are not even asked to sacrifice by paying for our wars and other big-ticket hostilities, since they are largely debt-financed, put on the national credit card for our children and grandchildren to pay off. Worst of all, the public has been entirely severed from life and death political decisions to fling our military into combat. We are no longer considered worthy of being told or even lied to about where, why, and with whom our flag has been committed. With so few of us feeling the sting of war and so many sensing no direct accountability for what is being done in our name, the public voice goes mute and protest slides to the fringes. Thus, the people's authority over the horror of war-making defaults to autocratic, profiteering warmongers, practically none of whom put their family members into harm's way. Yes, that's distressing. But instead of feeling depressed, let's turn aggressive, helping re-energize America's grassroots peace movement and put the people in charge of war policies. While this is not a fix-all, as we learned so painfully from Vietnam and Iraq, the people can be duped into the bellicose irrationality of war. It is nonetheless progress. If wars are us, it is undeniable that America will get into fewer of them, and we will have a stronger incentive to get out of those, proven deadly stupid. Throughout our history, courageous, progressive activism by individuals and groups has been the only reliable force for ending wars, the Vietnam protests, and restricting the expansion, the sane Freeze anti-nuke campaign. As always, imposing a measure of democratic sanity requires organizing regular people to get in the face of power. Ask your Congress critters how many of the 177 foreign deployments and wars that America is currently in can they name. Did they vote for a $738 billion war budget larded with waste, fraud, and corporate giveaways, not to mention Trump's Space Force boondoggle? How much campaign cash are they raking in from military contractors? The old rule of democracy building still applies. Question authority, then question authority's answers. And that was War and Peace by Dr. Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington. And now something I wrote, Total War Fatigue. Late spring or early summer, when the ground is dry and hard, is traditionally the season when winter restless armies clash. It is almost a contradiction. When life is renewed, armies sharpen their spears, load their cannon. But perhaps men make war because they are unable to give birth, the continuing winter of masculine discontent. Yet the world at the advent of summertide seems for a rare moment precariously close to peace, an unusual suspension of slaughter, which is the result of a few wars that ran out of gas at the same time. And perhaps more perniciously seems the unease. The prospect of peace is more irrational, after all, than the dark, brooding desire for bloody conflict, which might imply that humankind simply cannot resist folly at the threshold of sanity. One can almost feel the palpable sense of relief among world leaders when they are able to put on the war helmet and mobilize their militaries in the old familiar way, uncertain of a brave new world of peace, unexpectedly presented by the simultaneously collapse of a few combats. And perhaps more pertinently, as a result of invidious technology, warfare has advanced far beyond nature's strictures of weather or geography. The world's militaries, even the poorest from the most obscure geographies, are able to make war any time, any place. So-called state-of-the-art weapons float around the world, sold by arms merchants to anyone with money, good credit, or adequate prospects. The industrial nations are arms bazaars, producing and marketing exotically lethal weapons that immensely escalate tribal-level squabbles. Human antipathy is not seasonal and seldom dissipates for long, despite hardships of geography or weather. Old hatreds scab over only briefly and soon re-erupt. Bitter battles are incessantly fought over ancient or ancestral claims. Soldiers and police continually club and shoot into crowds all over the world. Sociopaths spray schoolyards with bullets. The only purpose for armies is the destruction of other human beings, their homes, cities, cultures, and creeds. Support for the armies is a war cry that enforces their continuance at war, whether attacking or defending. Soldiering is big business, the first order of every tribe, nation, or empire, as it has been since ancient times. But soldiers are little more than expendable pawns, readily discarded. Yet, without soldiers, there would be no wars, no Caesars, no Napoleons, no Hitlers. Soldiers feel compelled to carry out what they perceive as empirical or public mandate, and in the belief that any personal doubts would be met with disapproval, they generally and too often brutally do their duty, whatever horrible cost or consequences. Support for the soldiers acts contrarily as a relentless goad that pushes armies into irreversible horror. At the same time, the cheering war cries crush any who would conscientiously doubt or object. History records the lives and affairs of kings and generals, and of course their interminable wars. The hundreds of millions of common people impressed into wars, and whose homes, towns, occupations, and lives are decimated by them, have been ignored until only recently, and only because early mass media began linking their concerns and pandering to them to sell newspapers and the wars that imprisoned and quite likely murdered them. The poets might be right after all. The prospect of peace is more irrational than the dark, brooding penchant for murder that each of us hosts like a malevolent gene. Humanity's predilection for sinister error, folly, mass psychosis, and loathsome horror gives us our sense of humor and appreciation of the comedy of inescapable death. War is the human comedy. It is never necessary. There has never been a good war, only gruesomely bad wars that forcibly compel a tribe, a city, a nation to defend itself against the deathly ruthless aspirations of a misanthropic enemy. Every war can be traced back centuries and millennia, an ironic manifestation that humanity incessantly threatens its future by never getting past the conflicts of its earliest superstitions, which originated from the most elemental questions of life and purpose, frozen in mutually savage dogmas like fossils in ice. The most pitiless and never-remittent wars are religiously based, holy wars, crusades, jihads, whatever they may be called, are explosively recurrent among the same theolytical adversaries through the millennia. In particular, the cusps of millenniums seem to stir apocalyptic prophecies to greater carnage to obliterate opposing theologies. The previous millennium, in 1000 AD, sparked holy wars that persisted three centuries and have never ceased to re-arouse the faithful to holy slaughter. History seldom mentions compassion as an object of concern or as a vital ingredient to the structure of civilization. Inhumanity is exclusively human. Dehumanizing an enemy is common and ancient. The enemy are vermin or subhuman and represent repellent, insect-like hives, offensive to the true God and national interests. Decimation of the enemy is the goal. Demonizing the enemy is the policy. Extermination of the enemy is the method. It would be a grotesque irony that humanity might perish because it is unable to resolve conflicts from its earliest history, hopelessly mired in the irredeemable past and thus patently self-destructing its future. Perhaps, as summer evolves, armed horsemen on some grassy steppes are mounting their war horses. An enemy masses near an unsuspecting border. An insurrection prepares to topple a government. A newly established nuclear power readies to flex it at old enemies. Perpetual war perpetually engulfs planet Earth into perpetuity. Though we humans anxiously await Armageddon, we yet grasp at any moment of peace. Rather than holding our collective breath in collective horror, we should collectively take stock into what any soldier will tell us, that a lifetime can be packed into the nanoseconds between bullets. The 18th century soldier, Marshal de Saxe, wrote in Reveries of War in 1732, "The human heart is the start of all matters pertaining to war." And that was something I wrote, Total War Fatigue. And now, here come the Juneteenth knickknacks. Where are the lesson plans? By Michelle Norris. It is only a matter of time before a flood of Juneteenth trinkets, chocas, doodads, and gewgaws shows up on store shelves. But let's remember this. The enslaved people at the core of this new holiday were merchandise themselves before slavery finally came to an end. As Juneteenth becomes a holiday that offers another excuse for parties, parades, and prodigious capitalism, I am betting that a lot of Americans will fail to see that irony. We all know what happens to holidays in America. The thing that we are actually supposed to commemorate somehow gets shoved aside in a whirlwind of sales, travel incentives, and themed merchandise. Memorial Day, for instance, is more about the unofficial start of summer than honoring those lost to war. Labor Day closes out the season with nary a nod toward the labor movement or the workers who died in the Pullman strike that led to that holiday's creation in the first place. President's Day is supposed to be a time for honoring past leaders, but happens to fall at an opportune moment for automakers to roll out their discounts. With its timing on the calendar, its pithy moniker, and its roots in Black culture, Juneteenth is sure to be a marker for celebrations and a whole lot of barbecue. I'm down for that. And enslaved people getting their freedom is cause for celebration, family strong gatherings, and line dancing the wobble late into the night. But just know an avalanche will follow. We can be sure that marketing experts are, at this very moment, trying to come up with culturally appropriate fonts and uplifting music that has a funky downbeat. Somewhere, a circle of ad honchos is hunched over a white board, contemplating how to create a color scheme that will sizzle and pop and whisper liberty. You just know that there is a brainstorming session underway about how to create a design palette that nods affirmatively toward the mother continent of Africa, while possibly enticing all those customers who don't really see this as their holiday. As President Biden signed the bill into law establishing the new federal holiday, dictionary searches for Juneteenth shot up 8,200%. A new Gallup poll tells us that more than 60% of Americans know a little bit or nothing at all about Juneteenth, which marks the day in 1865 when the last enslaved blacks in Texas learned, 2 years late, that the Emancipation Proclamation had set them free. So this new holiday will mark the end of an abomination extended by deliberate and diabolical obfuscation. It is ironic and maybe even surreal that Juneteenth has been enshrined at a moment of so much racial turmoil. While we should applaud its arrival, we should also acknowledge that symbolism, while important, won't replace the need for substantive action to protect voting rights and save our democracy. But as ironies go, here is perhaps the biggest one. Juneteenth becomes a holiday at the very moment when teachers in a growing number of states will not be able to even explain the full story of why our country is commemorating emancipation. Conservatives in many states are blocking educators from using critical race theory to teach American school children about our past and present, as if that was actually even happening in K-12 classrooms. The new laws preventing the teaching of CRT to school children are often framed as a way to protect kids, more specifically, white kids, from feeling bad about themselves. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican, recently signed a bill that prohibits teachers from any kind of instruction that might make students feel anguish or guilt on account of his or her race or sex. Under this new law, classroom teachers must refrain from promoting the idea that an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive, whether consciously or unconsciously, quote, unquote. Many CRT critics can barely explain or define what the philosophy or approach to scholarship holds beyond bellowing about a conversation they don't much like. Instead, CRT has become a whack-a-mole weapon used to smash any attempt to discuss race or racism in the classroom or outside of it. The broad swipe against CRT is an attempt to sweep away almost any robust examination of how enslavement, followed by decades of legalized oppression, continue to shape the country today. I wish people who were concerned about the possibility of children being exposed to the alleged harms of critical race theory were equally concerned about children being exposed to actual racism. America loves the idea of freedom, so let's celebrate Juneteenth and its place on the calendar between Memorial Day and July 4th. But let's figure out how to truly commemorate this day. That will be a challenge, because few things rev up the engine of selective storytelling like a federal holiday, and because virtue signaling through holiday consumption is so much easier than doing the hard work of understanding what Juneteenth represents. And that was by Michelle Norris, Here Come the Juneteenth Knickknacks. And she wrote this for the Washington Post. And now, a poem by Carolyn Dunn. Human hunger for food, for happy children, for beauty, for relief from drudgery, for painlessness, for approval, for shade from heat and blankets for cold, for cleansing waters, for doing something well, for a really good joke, for peach pie with ice cream and people to share it with. Carolyn Dunn was Clatsop Community College librarian. She died in 2012 from ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. His 115th birthday was June 19th. He was born in 1903. This is Michael McCusker. Dylan Hauser Schalk engineers this program. The late Ed Niska, who died in the latter 1980s and was a pioneer KMUN programmer of Scandinavian music and a prominent Astoria fisherman, and whom I mentioned last week, was in Seoul, South Korea, the day North Korea invaded, as a member of an American fishing commission meeting with Korean counterparts. He was suddenly drafted into helping remove or destroy U.S. equipment and documents to keep out of North Korean hands, which he spent doing in almost panicked haste with the U.S. embassy people and army intelligence spooks the next few days before Seoul was abandoned. Ed and other American civilians were flown out of Seoul and were nearly attacked by North Korean MiGs, but U.S. jet fighters chased them away. Ed and the rest of the American fishermen were repatriated back to the USA soon afterward. Plagues are wars of infestation. Eventually they subside. Survivors warily or eagerly attempt to restart their lives and eventually forget about wars and plagues. But ultimately they reoccur. So be careful. Life is tenuous, even in the best of times. Remember your responsibilities to others the plague has most likely invoked, which is obviously also self-responsibility. And be seasonably silly. We have earned it.